What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Josh Larson. Adam, I can't do this anymore.
You what?
This is all terribly wrong.
Do you find me undesirable?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson. I think you're the most attractive of all my parents' friends. I mean that.
What's more awkward, Josh? Dustin Hoffman's Benjamin hooking up with Mrs. Robinson, or the two of us tackling our top five sexual awakening movies?
It's time you and I had the talk, Adam.
You know I have 17 kids. I think it's probably a little bit too late for that. Plus, we'll have a review of this year's Cannes Palme d'Or winner and sexually explicit coming-of-age movie, Blue is the Warmest Color. That and more.
You are the best looking of all my parents' friends, Adam.
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store.
For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM11. You're listening to Film Spotting. The MPAA has slapped a preemptive NC-17 rating on this episode, or at least on this week's top five sexual awakening movies. That's later in the show. But first, our review of the three-hour French romantic drama Blue is the Warmest Color. Hey, that's only slightly longer than the average Film Spotting episode.
How dare you.
L'enfance, c'est ça, hein? C'est là où... Vous en sortez, j'espère. C'est là où on n'est pas encore assez mûr, on n'est pas encore assez fort.
T'es gênée?
Ouais, un peu.
T'es marrante. C'est qui la fille qui est venue chercher la dernière fois?
Avec les cheveux bleus. Non, mais après, moi, je m'en fous, tu vois, que tu sois Gwyn. Mais le truc, c'est que t'es venue chez moi plusieurs fois dormir à poil dans mon lit, tu vois. Là, c'est un peu plus dur.
Je viens de te dire, je suis pas lesbienne, faut que je te le dise comment? Putain, t'es conne ou quoi?
On est bien, là.
Josh, one of the things we touched on briefly at the end of last week's show, previewing this one, was the controversy that's been swirling around Blue is the Warmest Color since it won the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival in May, and how we were going to handle the controversy about, among other things, its depiction of lesbian sex depicted by a straight male director, and that straight male director's, shall we say, bedside manner with his two female stars. My plan was a sound one, I thought. Watch the movie, as I usually do, knowing as little about it as possible, all details, not just the debate around it. And then, once I've got a pretty good handle on my reaction, seek out that conversation. If I found certain points to be compelling, if it informed my reaction, then I'd reckon with it. Some pieces of art and some debates might just require such a reckoning. So that was my plan. Then I discovered that the only chance I had to see the movie, all 2 hours and 55 minutes of it, was right before coming here to sit down with you to discuss it. So I'm basically lucky to even be spitting out what I am right now. A full-on reckoning was simply not going to happen, at least not this week on the show. That was my excuse. Josh, do you have an excuse, or did you dive into the rhetorical mire?
Didn't dive into it. I usually don't. I go into movies the same way, not wanting to know
but now you've come out
anything
of it.
About it. I came out of it, and I wanted to wait until we talked about it.
Okay.
I wanted to have a conversation about this film that, at least the first conversation we have about this film, that deals with the film. That's the most important thing to me. And obviously, the swirling opinions that surround any movie afterwards are of great interest, too. That's why we love criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Grew up reading it and wanting to dig into it and do it. But it's secondary. I mean, we've got to wrestle with the movie itself first. And I just feel that going into it, certainly knowing any details about the controversies would alter my perspective of the viewing experience.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe some people say that's not a fair way to go about it because you should know what you're getting into. But we're dealing with a work of art here that you want to wrestle with, what you make of it, what's presented on the screen. Then we can get to the other stuff. So yeah, I'm going in blind, if you want to put it that way. That's the way I went in, and that's the way this conversation will be, at least for now.
Well, as blind as we are, let's get to what we did know, or what we thought we knew about the movie. That the story about two young women who engage in a torrid love affair was extremely graphic. There was going to be lots of explicit sex, a notion backed up by the movie's NC-17 rating. I also knew that, along with winning the Palme d'Or at Cannes, the judges, for the first time ever, awarded the prize to the director, Abdelatif Kechiche, and the film's two stars, Adela Exarchopoulos and Léa Seydoux. I also had this running around in my head, courtesy of our friend Michael Phillips, after being unable to stop myself from reading the opening paragraph of his review. Michael said the leads, quote, subjected themselves to several months of movie-making hell to achieve the emotional, sexual, physical, and psychological rawness in forming this nearly three-hour love story. So to sum up, I knew the movie was long, full of graphic sex, dominated by its raw performances, was grueling to make, and at least one of the actresses and Julie Moreau, the writer of the original source material, the graphic novel Blue Angel, were less than thrilled. This may be my most vague setup question ever for you, Josh, but I'm curious, really, what you thought you were going to see and what you did see. What is Blue is the Warmest Color to you?
So I was aware of all of that, save for Michael's review as well. So I guess, you know, blind isn't the right phrase. We did have some information going into this. Here's how the movie struck me as I was watching it, and this is why I can completely understand that controversy erupted, not so much for the content itself, but because I think it's important to talk about this movie as a series of gazes, and they're different gazes. I think that shifts throughout the film, and I think that's where some of the complications come from. And that was part of the frustration for me, to be honest with you, is that I couldn't quite get my hands around what gaze are we dealing with here? And that would enable us to come down on a sounder judgment if it was one perspective the whole time. So these are the especially important questions for any film, but here, that I think we need to ask. Who is looking, and how are we as well? How are they looking?
Mm-hmm.
This is something that you keep coming back to, at least I did, as this movie went on. And again, the frustration was that the answers for me kept changing. I think there's definitely a gaze that's an adoring gaze of XR Cupolas and her face. If there's a prominent shot here, it's an extreme close-up
of
her face. I mean, if you don't find that face fascinating, this is going to be a long 3 hours.
It's probably at least two-thirds of the movie.
Probably right.
Yeah.
So we get a lot of that. And my sense of that was that it was adoring. Now, this could be the perspective of the director. This could be the perspective of us in the audience if we, as he seems to be, are awed by the actress's beauty and talent. It could be Emma's perspective, her lover, played by Léa Seydoux. That could be who we're seeing, although that her relationship mm-hmm. alters throughout the film. So I don't know that's fair to say that she's always adoring of Adele either.
Right.
So that's just one of these gazes. We also have, I think, a very voyeuristic gaze that I can understand causes problems, particularly in the repeated scenes of Adele sleeping, where she's vulnerable, unaware of the camera looking at her. Those have a different feel to me. And perhaps the most exploitative one is just a quick shot of her in the shower. That seems definitely set apart from how the camera looks at her and at other people at other points mm-hmm. in the film. And we're going to have to just tackle a completely different gaze, I argue, that the movie has during these explicit and very lengthy sex scenes.
You know, I'm glad you noted the shower scene, even though in the grand scheme of this film, it's such a small part. I mean, it's literally maybe 30 seconds.
But it stands out because it's a different.
But it stood out to me as well. And it stood out because, Josh, it was the only shot for me in the entire movie that I could put that voyeuristic tag on it. It seemed unnecessary. None of the other scenes, and we'll get into this surely as we talk here, seemed exploitative or any other terms like that. But the shower scene was one where there was no real context for it. It was just an opportunity for the male director to show his audience, it seemed, this body, the actress's body. And so it did stick out, and it did strike me as really unnecessary. But going into this film, to get back to my setup question for you, is I really thought it was going to be 2 hours and 25 minutes of hardcore sex, just a raw exploration of sexuality and lust and intimacy, almost an experimental film, maybe 30 minutes of sort of conventional narrative. That's just based on everything I'd heard or seen on Twitter. Somehow I'd had that image in my head. But then come to find, what are there? Maybe 2.5 sex scenes in the film, really, when you break it down? And yes, they are absolutely graphic. They're seemingly, at least, unsimulated. It's not what you expect to see in a traditional theatrical release or even an art house release. But those sex scenes within the larger context of the film are minor, I'd argue. There's a lot of traditional narrative here, maybe too much. Maybe that's a bad thing, actually. It's much more of a coming-of-age story, a 17-year-old becoming a woman and everything that entails. She goes from student to teacher, from virgin to someone who's had multiple lovers and had her heart broken. And I'm fascinated to dive into the debate more, and I am going to have to just dance around it a little bit because, as I said, I haven't had the chance, and I hate to address things that I really don't know what I'm talking about. I do that enough here on the show. I'm certainly not immune to the idea, though, that a straight male director would possibly direct lesbian love scenes differently than, say, a lesbian woman. And that might be problematic for some. He might direct them differently than a straight woman would. But he'd also direct it differently than a gay man probably would, or a straight man for that matter. So I am curious, Josh, ultimately, what some think those love scenes should be that they aren't, or shouldn't be that they are. Because for me, watching the film, I felt like the director was doing a service to this story, to these characters, by trying to show the full scope of it, including the full scope of that sexual relationship and their sexual encounters.
Okay, but let's back up a bit and not worry about the director's orientation at all and just talk about what did he direct?
Mm-hmm.
What are those scenes like? And to me, they're representing yet another gaze that the movie has, which is almost clinical. And I don't know what you attribute this to. Maybe that's what we'll get into when we look into the complaints.
But why is clinical bad? What should they be?
They're clinical in the sense that we are not learning anything more about their relationship, their psychology, or their emotion. It's almost anatomical the way these sex scenes are directed. And I think that's probably where some of the porn comparisons are coming from. It's very different from the gaze that we get of Adela while she's sleeping, which I said was adoring, or those close-ups. It's even different. It's not exploitative like that shower scene. It's very distanced and cool. And for me, it's at once extremely revealing in terms of its physicality, yet wholly unenlightening in terms of psychology or anything else. And there's something very interesting that's an irony to movie romances. And this is that when we learn too much about the couple on the screen as a viewer, some of the romance can fade. And this isn't just talking about sexuality. I'm talking about a mystery to a couple's relationship. And in these scenes, what happened, at least for me, especially because they were so lengthy and they went on, and the focus was very much, I felt, on what parts were there,
mm-hmm.
the mystery was kind of gone between them. I wished that Adela and Emma had had a little bit of something kept to themselves that I would have been more fascinated about. I'm not saying that the sex scenes had to be removed entirely, but the way these are filmed and the amount that they go on, it did not illuminate their relationship for me.
Moi, j'étais hyper Sartre dans mes années lycée.
C'est vrai?
Ouais. Ça me faisait du bien. Surtout dans l'affirmation de ma liberté et de mes propres valeurs. Tu vois. Et puis aussi son exigence dans l'engagement. J'adhère complètement.
Ouais, c'est un peu comme Bob Marley, quoi. Presque.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the new film, Blue is the Warmest Color. It opened this past weekend here in Chicago in limited release. You're listening to Adam Kempinar and the very prudish Josh Larson, who took issue, just kidding, Josh, with the sex scenes in Blue is the Warmest Color.
The opposite of what I just said.
I know it is, but it's fun to pigeonhole you and make fun of you a little bit here. I agree with you in your assessment that clinical is probably the best way to describe them. I don't think there's any doubt about that. That was a clear choice by the director, but I disagree completely that we aren't learning anything more about these characters through those clinical love scenes, or that isn't somehow doing a service, as I said, to these characters or to this type of relationship. Because when I was talking about showing kind of the full scope of a passionate sexual affair, what's the alternative? Kashish could have done something like the classic Hollywood soft focus. We could have had those ellipses cuts. They could have made it romantic. Have us buy into that same bag of tricks, the same conventions we've seen from love stories, male, female, whatever, homosexual, heterosexual, a million times, rather than really see and feel the rawness of the connection they have. So you're exactly right. He is subverting the notion of mystery. He's subverting the notion of there being additional romance beyond what they have physically and what they have emotionally as well. That only made them a more fascinating couple to me, not a less fascinating couple.
The problem also is that Exarchopoulos is the key to this film, and she gets lost in those scenes because we are further away from her there. And the reason that this movie ultimately works for me is I feel like she is constantly taking the picture back as an actress from, I don't know if it's the director, I don't know where it comes from, but from this feeling that she is being gazed upon, and she brings it back to the story of Adela. She roots mm-hmm. it in this character with an amazing performance. And I want to make sure
it's
we spend time giving credit to that.
To both of them, I think.
Because she's the reason this movie worked for me. And I think of a one scene in particular where she's at a protest march with right. her friends. And it seems like it's kind of a march and kind of a street party, really. She has just had one of her high school romances has kind of fallen apart. I believe that's where this happens in the film. And so she's kind of there, wounded a little bit. She's not really into the slogans. And in probably like 5 seconds, you see so many things pass on her face, from joy at the music like a kid. And then she all of a sudden gets into the chants, but there's a grimace on her face. She's right. just doing this half-heartedly, so that flickers by. And then when she realizes she's not really into it, she suddenly belts out this rage. The chant comes out like a rage, and that's obviously not what she's angry about. I mean, this actress is able to capture all of that, so we get the emotional volatility of a teen in those couple of seconds. And that's just one amazing bit of the film. And so throughout, I feel like she is grabbing the picture back and returning it to this more emotional portrait, psychological portrait, rather than a physical portrait. And I'm not saying that those two things always have to be separate. I mean, that would be a prudish approach. There can definitely be elements. And I think there are conversation scenes in bed between her and Emma, and also between her and a male character earlier, that are very evocative of this story in a way that the explicit scenes are not.
Well, we agree on one of the strengths of this movie, if we don't agree necessarily completely on the sex scenes, we agree on the strength being Adela, the character, and the lead actress, because as we touched on, the camera here is really so close to her. The film is dominated by extreme close-ups, especially during conversation scenes, and even during some tracking shots, I guess you want to call them that, where the camera is moving with her. It doesn't seem like they're using a Steadicam. They're really kind of following her, and it's bumpy. They're rough shots. The camera does move uneasily with her. And so when you have that, and even the conversation scenes where it's so close to her that any movement is accentuated, movement of the camera or movement of her face, it does give you this uneasiness. You are uncomfortable watching her at times, but I think that is obviously by design, and it does work. And I think a lot of times you'll hear people describe a movie as, we follow this character as they do such and such. And we mean it more figuratively, that the movie is centered around their story. But this really is a case where the camera seems to be stalking her. I felt like it's haunting her. It's always there with her, almost as if she's not aware of it.
No, that's definitely one of the gazes.
And that's the gaze, and that's also why her performance, I think, is so good. And I think we disagree, actually, a little bit on the sleeping shots. I don't see those sleeping shots as adoring at all. I don't think she's particularly pretty necessarily in those scenes. I don't think that's the point of those scenes. I do think the point of them gets back to the larger reason why her character works so well in the scope of this film. And they do at one point talk about Sartre and choosing the direction of your life and defining your own existence. She is always active. She is always in motion. She does everything with passion, with some volatility, the way she eats voraciously.
Yeah,
I mean, really, that's the word, right? Breathes, serves food even. When she cries, she cries. She holds nothing back. And when she has sex, it's voracious too. She doesn't hold anything back there either. That kind of character will carry you, or at least carry me, through a 3-hour movie. She definitely does here. And I think the director, even when he just introduces us to her, if you think about the opening 15 minutes of this film, he shows us her walking, running, learning, eating, sleeping. There's this notion that he's trying to give us the full sense of who this character is in all of her actions, how those actions define her as a person.
And I credit more Exarchopoulos with being able to make those scenes work.
Really?
I do. I think that they could easily have gone wrong if she didn't bring as many layers as she does to each of those scenes. She has no room for mistakes here, because that camera is on her so intensely and so insistently. I mean, obviously in editing, they can change things if there was a big mistake, but she is always on.
Yeah.
And there's not a false moment. And there's just this tension I feel. And I think Exarchopoulos wins out, and that's why the movie wins out for me. I think there's this tension between these competing gazes and where she's constantly trying to bring the film. Now, Kashish is very much aware of these complications, I think. And in a way, he's playing with us in using them, because there's one shot that's a gotcha shot. And it starts with a naked close-up of Adela, and it pans up her body. And we think, oh, wow, this is the most exploitative moment in the film.
Right.
And then suddenly it's revealed that, no, she's posing for Emma, who is painting her. Mm-hmm. And so that to me is, you know, just a little needle at us.
No doubt.
You don't always know what you're seeing or why you're seeing it or what your perspective is on this. So I do think that this is something that Kishish is aware of and brings complications to the film. I don't know if they always make it a better film.
Hmm. I think there's no doubt that he is aware of that. As I said, he is trying to subvert some expectations and some conventions, and I think that is mostly a strength of the film. That said, that hyper-awareness comes through in certain scenes, especially a lot of conversation scenes with the dialogue, that I did feel like it would have been better if he could have dialed it back a little bit and not had to actually put his thesis out there so many times. I felt like he was underlining things in the script that really didn't need to be there. I mean, how many times do we hear things like not only the Sartre conversation, but they're discussing Antigone in school, and it's about a young woman who makes a choice to finally stand up for herself. At one point, they're at a party, and all these artist types are talking about the male gaze. They're talking openly about how a man can depict a woman and whether or not they ever get it right and whether or not they should even be doing it. They don't have conversations around it, Josh. They have conversations directly about the subject the movie is exploring, down to as well one of the opening lines of the movie we hear is a character reading from a book and talking about how I am a woman and that defines me and that's the truth. So there's all these artistic little examinations going on that sometimes I felt did derail things a little bit. That hyper-awareness was a little bit of a problem. But the casting here of both actresses, and we've obviously touched on how much we like the performances, but it's perfect because Exarchopoulos is very much a woman. There's no doubt about that. But she's also a child. You see kind of those big teeth and those cherubic cheeks, and she needs a candy bar at one time to feel better, like she's a young kid. And you buy that. You buy that in her physicality, in her posture, and everything about her behavior. But at the same time, you also see that woman trying to burst through, and eventually does burst through. And Léa Seydoux, she's an actress who, as I was watching the film, I realized the best comparison I can make to any other actor or actress is I think she's the female Ryan Gosling. And I was someone who used to be pretty hard on him and have really come around on him as an actor. She gives that same kind of sensibility that suggests they're a little bit aloof. They're a little bit in their own world, a little bit in their own head, but they're intense and they're hyper-focused. They make you think you're the only person in the world when they're looking at you. And they always seem to say the right thing and always have the right movement. Every bit of her physicality struck me the same way Gosling strikes me on screen.
I don't know. I don't remember. Did she wear a hoodie at any point like he does in Blue Valentine?
Sadly, no.
She messes with?
But she has the great blue hair.
That's true.
I guess in the end for me, Josh, as I said, I was a little bit surprised by the movie, ultimately, because of what I went in with those expectations and what I found in terms of the narrative and where their relationship went. I did find it interesting to see how love, for example, as we see it play out, can be stifling. That being sort of the dilemma of a really passionate relationship, being able to say to someone truly with full conviction, you make me happy. And them saying, yeah, but it can't just be me. You have to find some fulfillment elsewhere. And them saying, why? What matters more than this? What matters more to you than me loving you? And I think where the movie ultimately comes out is that might be what growing up really is, or at least growing up in the sense, not of becoming an adult, whatever that means, but becoming an individual, becoming a whole person, is the ability to define yourself on your own terms and not be subject to someone else, not feel the need to define yourself by someone else.
Well, there's an age difference between them that I don't
know.
We ever do find out exactly what that is, but Léa Seydoux's character is much older. Emma's much older.
Well, we do. She's like a senior in college. So senior in college versus
about four or five years.
High school.
And I think that span is hugely accentuated at the end of the film, whereas you don't feel it quite as much when they first meet.
Blue is the Warmest Color is currently out in limited release, though I have a note here from our producer that apparently Idaho wasn't accepting the movie.
Huh?
So I'm just going to go with what's in front of me. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and facebook.com/filmspotting.
The Film Spotting poll up next asks, what is Matthew McConaughey's best performance? We really need Sam's McConaughey impression from Magic Mike here.
Oh, yeah, that was a show.
That was good. Then we dive right into our top five sexual awakening movies. Don't worry, we're going to put those black censor bars over parts of the conversation to protect the innocent. Stay with us. Oh, 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 oh. Hey, everybody. Just want to jump in here to remind you that this episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website, portfolio, or online store. For a free trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use offer code FILM11.
Obviously, we've been promoting Squarespace for a while here on the show. We like to feature listener websites to give you a taste of what you can do with Squarespace, and we're going to take that up a notch here this week, Josh. We're asking listeners to send us a tweet. We're at FilmSpotting with a link to your new or existing Squarespace website. Just use the hashtag FilmSquarespace. One word, FilmSquarespace, and we'll check out your site. Three Squarespace sites will be randomly chosen to get 3 additional months free to your Squarespace subscription. It's a $30 value. You also get a Squarespace t-shirt, and you'll get a mention in a future episode. So a lot of bang for your buck if you just use that hashtag. And if you're using Squarespace, you know that they're constantly improving their platform with new features, new designs, and even better support. It's a very easy system to use, but if you want some help, they've got an amazing support team that works 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And it all starts at just $8 a month and includes a free domain name if you sign up for 1 year.
You can start a trial without even using a credit card. Just start right away building your website. When you do decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code FILM11 to get 10% off and to show your support for Film Spotting. Don't forget, send a tweet with a link to your Squarespace website to hashtag FilmSquarespace. That's hashtag FilmSquarespace, and we'll check it out. Squarespace has everything you need to create an exceptional website.
About it. All right, rule number one, this is the what can you touch and not touch rule. Can you touch it? Can you touch it? No, 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 no. Second touch. Can you touch it? Can you touch it? No, 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 no. That too, the law says that you cannot touch. But I think I see a lot of lawbreakers up in this house.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Sadly, we don't have our producer Sam here to do his take on Matthew McConaughey's Dallas from Magic Mike. At least we don't have to see the strip tease again. We have something even better than Sam pretending. The real thing, McConaughey there as Dallas from the Steven Soderbergh film Magic Mike. And we're going to get to a McConaughey-related poll question here in a bit. I really am excited to see where listeners are going to come out on that question. But right now it's time for Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last time Adam and I massacred this scene.
You're playing with my mind.
I'm trying to play with your body.
I knew it. You're trying to seduce me.
Well, of course I'm trying to seduce you, for God's sake. I'm doing a damn poor job of it. Aren't I pretty?
Oh, God, I think you're real cute.
Cute? Baby ducks are cute. I hate cute. I want to be exotic and mysterious.
You are. You're exotic and mysterious and cute, and so I better leave.
That was Tim Robbins as Ebby Kelvin Nuklealoosh and Susan Sarandon as Annie Savoy in Bull Durham from 1988, a movie written and directed by Ron Shelton, which means this is the second week we featured a movie from a director whose debut film is, everyone would probably agree, far and away the best thing they've ever done. Diminishing returns since then. Jan de Bont's Speed, we did last week.
Right.
Now Shelton, think of what he did after Bull Durham, which was 88. White Men Can't Jump, Cobb, Tin Cup, Play It to the Bone, Dark Blue, and Hollywood Homicide. That was 2003,
yeah.
And I don't think he's done anything since.
Well, I will say this. White Men Can't Jump, total guilty pleasure of mine, except I don't feel guilty about it. I actually
kind of love that movie. Of that one.
And speaking of Woody Harrelson, even though he's in Play It to the Bone, that movie is terrible. Wow, that movie is bad. The boxing movie with Antonio Banderas.
I don't even remember that one. Okay.
And I'm sorry, Tin Cup fans, but no, it doesn't come anywhere close to reimagining or revisiting the glory of Bull Durham. So you're right, Ron Shelton has had a tough go of late, and it probably didn't help that we butchered his lines last week on the show. Dave Grattan from Linkin Park Chicago noted the tie-ins. The South, that was our top 5 movies set in the South. And not a show tie-in, but a reality tie-in, the World Series just concluded. Dave also says, am I hearing you right? Planning another year-end wrap-up show and a 500th show blowout? Could this mean 2 live events in 2014?
I hadn't thought about it that
That's
way.
That's what it means.
It does mean that, doesn't it? Do we have a date on that January
Yeah,
one?
January and end of July. I think January 11th and then July 28th, I believe, or somewhere around the 26th and 27th. All those details coming soon. Obviously, the January show details will be coming very soon.
Yeah, put that on the calendar now.
We do have to get the tickets out there, but we do have two live shows in 2014 if our hearts can take it.
We also heard from Bernd Linhart, says he's originally from Louisiana, writing now from Santa Monica, California. The answer is Bull Durham, and the connection would be Southern movies, since Durham is in North Carolina. I tried to come up with an artistic angle, like Secret Sunshine's Lee Chenay's use of religion to get what she wants, which is similar to Annie's use of her baseball religion to get what she wants out of Crash and Nuke. But alas, that would be like thinking Oswald didn't act alone and that the novels of Susan Sontag are literature.
Well, when we do break down at some point and do our top five movie speeches, well done, Bern, because that speech, those lines from that great speech from Crash Davis, of course, played by Kevin Costner, will probably be my number one. Spoiler alert, I do love that speech to Annie there as he gets ready to head out the door. If you want to hear our scene from Bull Durham, plus Josh's review with Michael Phillips of 12 Years a Slave and our top five movies set in the South, you can get that show at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. Without any further ado, Josh, reach into the Film Spotting hat, not nearly as brimming as it should be for one of the best all-time sports movies, but, you know, it is what it is. Reach in and pick out this week's winner.
Winner is Ken Pace from Woodland Park, Colorado.
Congratulations, Ken. Email feedback at filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with your free six-month subscription to Fandor.com.
That was the greatest acting I have ever seen.
I just don't know how you do it, Gary. How do you make yourself so somber and emotional to make everybody cry like that?
It's not that hard, really. I just think about the saddest moment in my life.
Well, we've got sex, we've got violence, we've got it all in Massacre Theater coming up. Presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent, foreign, and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting. Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
You know, it only just now occurred to me, Josh, that my Fandor recommendation for the week is a perfect hint for our Massacre Theater
Very
performance.
Nice.
Because if you follow the director Alex Ross Perry on Twitter, as Film Spotting does, you may know that one of our Golden Brick nominees from last year, a film I nominated, The Color Wheel, is now available over at Fandor.com. It is a movie I highly recommend. It is a movie that you probably would best describe as disturbing, but it's one of those movies where it doesn't really get disturbing until about the last 5 minutes. So up until then, there's a lot of hilarity, there's a lot of awkwardness, there's some good performances and a pretty entertaining story, but yes, it does
okay. It
does go somewhere, and that's all I'm going to say about it as we get to this week's scene, which might be the most disturbing scene we've ever chosen to massacre in the history of the show.
I certainly hope so.
I don't know if listeners are ready for this.
Here, you're going to need this too,
because
you throw the rock,
right? Oh yeah,
right?
Sound effects. You're giving more hints here. You started off, you're going to play the female this time.
You didn't need to specify that with what I'm going to do.
That's true. And action.
This is where we live, Dickie. This is our home, now and forever.
No, I could never live here with just you. I don't even like you. You never used to laugh at me. You never used to have secrets you wouldn't tell me.
Well, you're not so perfect either. I've seen you playing with it, and I'll tell your father if he ever gets here.
You, I hate you.
You almost hit me!
Take it back. Take back what you said.
I've seen it all. What happens after you've been doing it a long time?
Shut up! That's not fair peeking. I don't peek on you.
That's a lie! You're always staring at my puppies.
And scene.
And
puppies.
If you don't stop staring at my puppies, Adam, I will file a sexual harassment complaint.
I can't help it. Can we say puppies on NPR?
We'll find out.
If you know what film we just massacred, and I guess we should just apologize that you had to hear that. But if you know what film we did brutally destroy, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, November 11th.
Winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Blaine? His name is Blaine? Oh, that's a major appliance. That's not a name.
Just because I'm going out with Blaine doesn't mean I can't be friends with you. I mean, it doesn't change the way I feel about you.
Oh, that's very nice. I'm glad. Here's the point, Annie. I'm not particularly concerned with whether or not you like me. Because I live to like you, and I can't like you anymore. So when you get your heart splattered all over hell and you're feeling really low and dirty, don't look to me to help pump you back up, Because maybe for the first time in your life, I won't be there.
Nothing better to help us forget what just happened there in Massacre Theater than John Cryer as Ducky with Molly Ringwald from Pretty in Pink, the John Hughes film from 1986. And as we were anticipating our discussion this week of Blue is the Warmest Color, a coming-of-age movie, we wanted to know which coming-of-age movie you most relate to. So we posed this poll question to you. The only person who understood you was, and here were your choices. A charming outcast like Say Anything or Edward Scissorhands, a dangerous outcast like in Badlands or Heathers, someone who is too old for you like Harold and Maude or An Education, your teacher slash mentor like Dead Poets Society or Almost Famous, your weird best friend, Pretty in Pink or Superbad, or maybe nobody. You didn't have anybody to lean on like the characters in The 400 Blows and Welcome to the Dollhouse. Or finally, this was only for Zach Braff. The answer was Natalie Portman. Like in Garden State, she's the only one who ever got you. How did it come out, Josh?
It was a three-way race for last place, actually. Too old for you, 4%. Dangerous outcast, 5%. And someone other than Zach Braff voted because Natalie Portman got 6%.
Yeah,
of the
I don't
vote.
Think Zach Braff alone makes up 6% of our audience. So there was some shenanigans there.
I think so. Your teacher mentor came in with 16%, and there was a tie here, also 16% for a charming outcast. So up at the top, pretty close, nobody got 24% of the vote, but the winner was your weird best friend with 29%.
Wow. That's a little bit of a surprise to me, but maybe it's because I was thinking of your weird best friend a la Ducky. And, you know, you really have to have someone eccentric and charismatic in your life to have someone like John Cryer in that film. I never did.
John Cryer is one in a million is what you're saying.
He is. Okay. He really is.
Gotcha.
Let's hear from Amber, location undisclosed, and as we're about to read, it's for a good reason. I chose the dangerous outcast option because in high school, I fell in love with a sociopath. That isn't a metaphor. I literally fell in love with someone who would go on to be diagnosed as a sociopath. I don't know what it says about me that the only person who could understand young me was devoid of most emotions.
Yikes.
Wrong show. Wrong show, Amber. We can't help you.
Kristen wrote in. She took the Zach Braff vote. She says, I chose the Natalie Portman option because there were no other specific choices for if you felt like your boyfriend slash girlfriend was the only person who understood you in high school. Of course, I had a new boyfriend each year of high school, but hey, I was a hopeless romantic.
Yeah, I think we did sort of intend that either the charming outcast or the dangerous outcast would take that boyfriend or girlfriend void. But then again, supposedly not every boyfriend or girlfriend out there could be called an outcast. Christopher in Lexington, Kentucky, he's not an outcast. He says, I went with the nobody answer, not so much because of the film suggested for it, but because of another film that was a touchstone of my teen years, and that's Ordinary People from 1980. What I find unusual at this point in my life about this attachment to the movie that I had in my teens was that I was a teen in the early 90s, so the film was already a decade old or more at the time, but I still felt more connected to Conrad Jarrett than any of the other teens that were in films at the time. I think the key was that the character was not necessarily an outcast in the usual way, but seemed more to cast himself out. Also, the disconnect between parent and child was never more powerfully done without there being actual abuse of some sort than in this movie, and that really hit home with me as well. A good choice there, I think,
from
Christopher. Thanks to everyone who voted and sent in their comments. I think listeners will have a fun time with this week's poll question as well, Josh. As we tease Matthew McConaughey, he's got a movie coming out, The Dallas Buyers Club. We do plan to discuss that next week on the show. So previewing that, we are asking you to dwell on the magnificence of Matthew McConaughey. The question is simple. What's Matthew McConaughey's best performance? Not your favorite performance.
Not your favorite.
No, not your favorite. What do you think his best performance is? What are the options?
Wooderson from Dazed and Confused, Jake Brigantz from A Time to Kill, Buddy Deeds from Lone Star, Dallas, who we previously heard from, Magic Mike, Mud from Mud, or Joe Cooper, otherwise known as Killer Joe.
Yeah, there you go. Your choices. I tried to go in chronological order there, though. I'm not sure I got it 100% right. I will admit I didn't bother to look it up. But those are your choices. Josh, do you want to divulge your pick right now or wait till next week?
This is really tough. Maybe I should think on it.
Okay.
Unless, do you have your answer ready?
I don't really, but right. I will say this. It was very tempting to go with one of his smaller performances, and there are two really, really good ones there. But I think if you are going to pick his best, you have to weigh whether or not it's a supporting or lead performance. So I'm inclined to go with a bigger turn. We'll see.
That's where I'm leaning to.
Okay. Well, we want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
Oh, I almost forgot. I bought some magazines. Do you want to just flip to the center section? Well, this is the female form, and they have focused on the breasts, which are used primarily to feed young infants, and also in foreplay.
Right.
This is This is Hustler.
Eugene Levy there, not just being a helpful father, a too helpful father, if you will, to Jason Biggs, but helping us transition, Josh, into this week's Film Spotting Top 5 Sexual Awakening Movies.
Do you think this would be less awkward if we had Jim's dad moderating here? Or more
definitely,
awkward?
But it would be better. It would be infinitely better. American Pie, not a movie. I'm going to be snobbish and admit I considered it all for my top five. Didn't really come close, Josh, but I think I have a few pretty decent picks. What about you?
I did consider American Pie. Do you like it at least?
You know, I do.
Okay,
the first
good.
American Pie I thought was pretty decent.
All right.
I maybe didn't like it quite as much as you, but it was
honorable
okay.
mention for me.
Well, before we get to our picks or any honorable mentions, do you want to set up the list at all? I mean, is it pretty obvious, or is this one you had to think about? Did you have to do a lot of research,
Josh? I took this one at face value,
No,
Adam.
Honey, it's for the show. It's
yeah.
for the show, seriously.
There was a conversation.
Well, then dive right in. You're number five.
Number five comes from one of the filmmakers, one of the first filmmakers to come to mind for this, and it's because of the marathon we did, Max Ophuls. And I thought La Ronde would work as a sexual awakening movie. You don't seem to think so.
No,
but
I just would never connect sexual awakening and Ophuls. I wouldn't think of him. My mind immediately went dirty, think of Ophuls.
There's
I think of him
a lot
elegant.
Of sex in his movies.
But there
we
is.
Don't see it all.
I think it's an inspired choice, Josh.
Well, thank you. Then I'll proceed.
Please do.
This is his 1950 ensemble piece. Follows a chain of interconnected lovers in turn-of-the-century Vienna. And we have Anton Walbrook as our charming narrator and host to all of this. I found this movie to be very much about the thrill of infatuation, much more so than I think you did, Adam. And awakening here, the sexual awakening here, is largely pure bliss. It's that early thrill. We get some really affecting scenes here. There's the one of the flirtation between a maid and the son of her employers. Later on, that same nervous bachelor is attempting to woo the married older woman played by Danielle.
That maid
Dare
scene,
you.
Though, is really erotic. For a movie like that made in that time, it really is.
Yeah, I think we highlighted that one in the marathon, too. So those are the sort of scenes that came to mind. And many other interconnected couples in this film have similar moments. So sex in La Ronde is seen as this endless awakening, but as long as you keep moving, you got to keep moving
That's true.
To that next person.
Well, the only preface I have for my picks is, as I was whittling down my choices, I realized that there are a lot of coming-of-age movies that, of course, involve sex. That's a major aspect of coming-of-age, but that didn't really fit for me. So, for example, if they weren't truly about sex, a movie like Fish Tank, a movie like An Education, starring Carey Mulligan, those are movies where sex obviously does play a key role in the story, but I think the movie ultimately is about a lot of things beyond that. It also had to be a movie that I felt was truly about an awakening. Fair enough, right? So a movie like Short Bus from John Cameron Mitchell, a movie I actually like quite a lot, speaking of explicit sex, it's definitely about sex, but I don't know if it's really about discovering it. A lot of the characters in that movie, yes, they're fixing out some problems in their sexual lives, but they're all kind of older. They're at least out of high school and college or maybe older than that. So it didn't quite work for me. My sort of litmus test, Josh, I don't know if there was a particular scene you had in mind or something that kind of propelled you along, but for me, it was Joan Allen in the bathtub in the movie Pleasantville, in black and white, and she discovers the joys, if you will, of self-pleasure, and everything turns to color.
Color, right.
None of my picks have a moment quite that revelatory or bombastic, but I did kind of use it as my guide. So with that, my number five is the 1983 film Liana, from a writer-director I'm a big fan of, John Sayles. It was his second movie after Return of the Sea Caucus 7. Linda Griffiths plays the title character. She's married to a real kind of jerk of a film professor, actually, a media professor. They're at some university in New Jersey, and she takes a child psychology course to have something in her life to better herself, and she meets the instructor, Ruth, and they do realize they have some kind of a connection. That connection turns into an affair. And of course, it being 1983, but even, Josh, if it was 2003 or 2013, that causes complications because of husbands and kids and friends and jobs. You watch it now, it does feel a little bit dated. You feel the 30 years for sure. In terms of look, Sayles has always been a pretty straightforward visual director. It was shot on 16 millimeter. It seems a little bit like a TV movie when you see it, even with the subject matter. It's the type of thing you might see on Lifetime. But of course, I think what elevates it is Sayles' writing and his sensitivity with uncomfortable moments and the truth he mines from them. The key scene for me is where we learn that there are really two sexual awakenings for Liana. She goes for dinner at Ruth's house, and up to this point, any physical desires have been unexpressed, but they're drinking wine, they're on the couch, they're pretty close together, and Ruth asks Liana about her first crush. Liana tells a story that reveals more than she probably intended to.
I used to go to camp up north in the summer. There was this one counselor. She was 15, maybe 16. I was so glad when I got her squad. She taught us field hockey. I had a sort of crush on her. No. I was in love with her.
During that sequence, Ruth can't stop herself from touching Liana. She just, I think, kind of grazes her hair lightly. And as a viewer, it's such an emotionally raw scene, and she's being so intimate that you don't blame her a bit. You think, yes, you have to touch her in that moment. And it does lead to Liana finally getting to act on her feelings, these feelings she's hidden away since that camp experience she talked about in the story. Camp there again, Josh, to go back to American Pie. So there was this sexual awakening she had as a teen, but now the awakening where she finally embraces her desire for another woman instead of a man. It's a really good film from Sales.
Just please tell me you didn't take your Joan Allen inspiration so seriously that you composed your list in the bathtub.
I did not. I'm sorry that I have to spoil that image for you.
Number four, Brokeback Mountain, Ang Lee's 2005 cowboy romance, which can be seen as the awakening and then the struggle with that awakening of Heath Ledger's and Estelle Marr, who has this tortured on-and-off affair with Jake Gyllenhaal's Jack Twist. You get the impression that Jack represents Ennis's first gay experience, certainly his first relationship, and this becomes the sole source of joy in his life, but also just presents this difficult internal struggle that he has for the rest of his life. Is it a stretch to say that Brokeback Mountain led to something of a sexual awakening in the American public, too? It kind of feels that way. It felt that way a little bit then. And in retrospect, I really think that's what happened. I mean, it was this huge hit across all sorts of demographics. I remember it playing in suburban theaters here in the Chicago area that would normally never carry a film with this subject matter. And when you think about the Supreme Court's DOMA decision earlier this year and how many people noted, wow, how quickly opinions changed in what, maybe a decade or so. You have to think that a movie like Brokeback Mountain maybe had a little bit to do with that.
Maybe it did. It's a great film. It was an honorable mention for me. My number four is a movie that you brought up recently here in a top five. It made your Hostage movie top five, though that was an unconventional choice, a little bit odd, but I think it probably does work. It's also a former Golden Brick winner here on Film Spotting. So not a movie whose praises really need to be sung by me here, but the movie is Dogtooth from the Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos. And I think the reason it really stuck out to me, Josh, was as I reflected on it, it occurred to me, and I looked back at my notes from my top 10 of the year, where I think it was my number four, and of course, where we did award at the Golden Brick, I talked about a lot of aspects of the film or danced around certain aspects of the film, but I never once talked about how big of a role sex plays in this movie. It is huge. It is all-encompassing to this film.
That's when it all starts to go wrong.
Really, exactly. You've got a mother and father, and they have three children, and they do kind of keep them hostage here in this compound and have taught them their way of viewing the world. They've got their own vocabulary. Everything is unique to this world they've created, but sex is a big part of it where, in fact, the only person who they bring in from the outside is someone who has sex with the older son character. Obviously, they feel like he has to have his desires met if they're not going to let him out. I did want to read this because I thought it was a great line from the critic Simon Abrams from his DVD review on Slant. He's talking about the first sex scene in the film, and he says, a male, possibly in his late 20s, and a slightly older woman, probably in her mid to late 30s, strip unceremoniously and sit cross-legged mere centimeters apart from each other. They examine each other's private parts, or at least it looks like they're respectively staring at each other's crotches. This scene sets the standard for the film's presentation of human interaction as a series of barbarous games and rituals that have no fixed meanings. Almost every scene is a new contest, and each contest has a new set of rules pulled out of thin air by the participants for reasons unknown. I think that really does capture everything about the film, but particularly how sex is depicted, where it is just like learning a new word or what they think is a new word and the correct definition. All these actions that we, through society, through film, through our own interactions or music or whatever, have come to identify and understand what the rituals mean, you take them completely out of context, and you do have to come up with your own definition for them, and the movie really does play with that and explore that. And as you talk about Dogtooth, you have to think about how sexual awakening does seem to always correspond with sort of an intellectual awakening into adulthood. I'd even go so far, Josh, this is your territory more than mine, but you think about, obviously, the tale as old as time, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden and the Tree of Knowledge. And sure, as soon as they become aware, what do they become aware of? They become aware of their sexuality. I think Dogtooth is really a movie that's about that discovery of themselves physically as well as emotionally or psychologically. And they are leaving the Garden of Eden, or not, depending on how you look at it. But that garden that their parents have tried to recreate is definitely there in this film. So Dogtooth is a movie that really probably doesn't need to come up more on this show. I think listeners have gotten the point by now. But at the same time, I really hadn't explored that specific area of it before.
No, it's a good pick for this list. Still probably a better Hostage movie, but
of course.
We're going to name our top three sexual awakening movies when we come back. Adam, please tell me you're not going to be singing the praises of Dirty Dancing again.
I've had the time of my life, Josh, and I owe it all to you.
Stay with us.
Shout to the heavens, to the sky. Why can't I be what you want me to be? I know that it's impossible, impossible, but I can dream. I'm not you. You're not me. I try. This is all I can be. I found it hard to break your heart. It's made of stone after all. But that's no excuse for me to lose my.
We get now to the thank you segment of Film Spotting Donations, where we acknowledge some of our new donors. We appreciate every cent we get from our listeners who send some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. Josh, we have three new donors we're going to single out this week, including John in Brooklyn, New York.
I donated $50 to Film Spotting since I have yet to donate anything to the podcast. I really enjoy your film critiques. I also 100% agree with Adam's sentiments on The Avengers and think that it is one of the most overrated films in recent years. Anyway, great podcast and keep up the good work.
So John in Brooklyn might actually be my mom.
Yeah, sounds a little bit
saying it.
I think I went, what, 3 out of 4 stars on
three.
The Avengers? I'd call that appropriately rated.
Okay, well, the one downside to John agreeing with me on The Avengers is that anybody listening who wasn't aware of that and was maybe considering donating to the show, now there's no way they're going to PayPal and sending me anything. So just consider your donation going to Josh, if you will.
There
that
you go.
That makes you feel better. Thank you, John, for that Silver Club donation. We also got a Silver Club donation from Carl G. Martin in Minneapolis, and he sent us a really nice note, Josh, including a great testimonial for Shutterstock. So I know we're going to hear from Carl and his comments on a future episode. Let's get to another new donor. That's Laura in Ottawa, Ontario. And I think we should close, Josh, with some comments from Dan and Amanda, also in Brooklyn. They should get together with John and hang out. I know we have a lot of listeners in that borough. Dan is the guy who last week on the show, we read his comments that accompanied his donation, but I noted that PayPal cut them off.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't get to hear what Dan had to say, get to hear the full breadth of his thoughts. Well, he decided to pick up where he left off. So some final thoughts from Dan and Amanda.
My wife and I drive to and from Brooklyn and Columbus with some frequency, and we never get in the car without several Film Spottings in tow, waiting to liven up the duller stretches of our drive, of which there are many. Your show is always illuminating and compelling. Your arguments are vibrant and fully realized, and we always end up wanting to see whatever movie you've discussed, even if you both disliked it. so we're more than happy to pony up a little bit of money for whatever encouragement and financial help it provides, and because it gives me the opportunity to say that The Fugitive deserved better than a mere honorable mention in the Best of 1993 list, though my dazed and confused loving wife was plenty pleased. Keep up the great work.
Thanks so much for that, guys. Of course, if you're not ready to financially donate to the show, but you still want to support us, you can go to iTunes and rate us there, give us a star rating, or give us a star rating and a positive comment. It does just take a second. We are well over 1,000, but we're going to set a new goal soon and try to hit that. So again, thanks to everyone who has gone to iTunes, and thanks to everyone who supports us, whether it's a new donation or whether you're a $2 or $5 or $10 a month subscriber. A quick note about our featured musical artist this week, a group I had never heard of. This is one of those Sam Van Halgren picks that now I'm a big fan of, Lily and Madeline. They're based out of Indianapolis. They're sisters. Their self-titled debut album was just released. You heard the songs Disappearing Heart and Come to Me. Depending where you are and when you're hearing this, you could catch Lily and Madeline in Arlington, Virginia. That's Film Spotting East on Friday, November 8th. They'll be in Detroit for a show in early December. If you want to hear more or learn more, go to lilyandmad.com. Also, Josh, last week on the show, Michael Phillips had to be here and sit in for me because I wasn't able to see 12 Years a Slave before recording. Unfortunately, I still haven't seen it, so I haven't been able to listen to that episode yet. I'm sure you guys were great, but I'm going to have to put it on hold. I'm going to have to put it on hold because I just don't want to hear what you guys have to say until I see it. But for many of our listeners out there who listen to the episode, who've seen the movie and want to know even more, you got to check out the Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith.
Yeah, he recently launched Backstory Issue 08, and what he's got in there, along with the usual filmmaker interviews, full-length screenplays, and videos you can watch, is an interview with director Steve McQueen. So he weighs in, along with the 12 Years a Slave cinematographer Sean Bobbitt and actress Lupita Nyong'o, who Michael and I both highlighted for her role as Patsy. There's also a Blacklist script that you can read there. If you want to see high-res images of the cover for Backstory and see the table of contents, just check out backstory.net.
My disappearing heart will change her name, and we will never be the same as we once were. Now and again, I find myself wishing.
Hi there, Film Spotting Original Recipe listeners. Matt Singer here from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast, and on our latest episode, we film our descents into troubling violence as we discuss The Dirties, the Canadian indie about bullying that was picked up for distribution by Kevin Smith.
And inspired by the found footage style of The Dirties, we'll take a look at some other films, big and small, that follow the same format and are currently available for you to stream. And we'll also debate that all-important question, at what point do you say, hey, time to put down the camera and run. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us on iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Andrew Stanton. I'm the director of films like Finding Nemo and WALL-E, and now John Carter, and you are listening to Film Spotting.
I'm sorry, Ruth. I shouldn't have slept with you. I don't know. It's never happened before. All right, of course it's happened. But never in this situation. Never with a client.
Don't worry, it wasn't anything.
Look, I was there too. I think it was a little more than that. I was trying to be comforting.
You don't think I was faking it, do you?
You're listening to Film Spotting, where we're in the midst of our top five sexual awakening movies. That was the very odd couple of Holy Smoke, my number three pick for this list.
So you're going to have two Jane Campion movies on your list?
Just this one. Just
wow.
This one.
Okay.
And this is probably a Campion film that's only for Campion diehards. So yes, Adam, your dismissal of The Piano, which just about everyone loves, you probably shouldn't bother with this one.
No.
Then. No. Things, they're really out there here. I mean, it ends with Harvey Keitel wearing lipstick and a dress. Lots of other oddities going on. Kate Winslet plays Ruth, a young woman from Australia who falls under the persuasion of this guru while she's traveling to India. Her family goes there, brings her back, and then they hire this American cult deprogrammer, Keitel, to snap her out of it. Now, the construct here, I'll admit, it rings pretty false, the way things are set up and how they get this into place. But what Campion wants to do, she wants to get Winslet and Keitel locked up in this shack in the Australian outback for this battle of the sexes. And once they do engage, sexuality, of course, becomes a weapon for both of them. Now, Keitel's deprogrammer, he very much equates the authority he has in this position with sexual power. He doesn't directly abuse his subjects, but there's a side relationship he has with Winslet's brother's wife, and you can see that he loves this position of power that he has, and he exercises sexuality as part of that. Winslet eventually pushes him over the edge, though, and then the power shifts towards her. But the really interesting thing about Holy Smoke is that it doesn't do so in a way where we can easily declare her the winner when the movie is over. It's much more complicated than that. Really, Holy Smoke is, it's a sexual awakening for both characters in a lot of ways. Keitel becomes awakened to seeing what sex can be when it's separated from control. And Winslet's character, she's awakened to the ramifications of combining sexuality with cruelty. So Holy Smoke, oddball Campion film, but one worth seeking out.
Well, Jane Campion only wishes she could be as oddball as the director of my number three pick. We're going to go from my number four, Dogtooth, a movie clearly influenced by the surrealism of Luis Buñuel, to a Buñuel film. My number three is Belle de Jour. It, of course, stars Catherine Deneuve. She plays Severine. She's a young housewife. She loves her husband. Her husband loves her. But for whatever reason, they just can't really express themselves intimately. At least Severine can't with him. And, well, we come to find that she's got a lot of fantasies going on in her head about the type of intimacy she would prefer, things like domination and bondage. So she does what any nice young housewife would do. She decides to act out those fantasies by joining a high-class brothel. And she does go to work there and gets involved and entangled with many other men, but does get that opportunity with some of those men to explore those fantasies. I think it was so important for me to include this movie on the list, besides the fact that it's a classic from Buñuel, just because it was a little bit of an awakening for me, Josh, in the sense that when I saw it, and I believe I was a freshman in college, it was probably the first time I remember watching a movie where I was confronted with quote-unquote aberrant sexual desires, where I became aware of the fantasy element to sex and seeing someone in the character of Severine who is one way in everyday life with her husband, with her friends, with her neighbors and everyone around her, and how she presents herself, but has this other side to her. And then, of course, what the movie explores is what happens when those desires go from fantasy to reality. It's a film I really do need to revisit, and we've said it many times that Buñuel needs to be a marathon topic, and I think at some point down the road, he definitely will be.
Yeah, I would be all for that.
But Deneuve and Buñuel here, really what the film is all about for me is their ability to shatter comfy bourgeois attitudes about sex. It did have an impact on my sheltered small town Iowa bourgeois 18-year-old self anyway when I saw it, and that's why Belle de Jour is my number three.
Yeah, let's get that marathon on the schedule. I'd like to do that. My number two is The 40-Year-Old Virgin, the 2005 breakout film for both its star, Steve Carell, and writer-director Judd Apatow. I'd leave it to a raunchy Hollywood sex comedy to actually bring some rationality to the idea of sex. I mean, here in this oversexed culture, we've got a hero who's pretty much just fine without it, and it's not the end-all be-all of existence for him. And then when it does become a part of his life, that's the whole trajectory of the narrative, the movie kind of acknowledges how life is enriched by sex, but doesn't necessarily have to be defined by it, how it can be one facet of a full life, which is a different picture of what you'd normally get from a lot of Hollywood films.
Listen. Mm-hmm. I really like you. I think I'm falling for you. I don't know, I kind of see this going somewhere.
I do too.
I just think we should just go crazy on each other.
Okay.
Okay.
And I think it's also interesting in this picture that Catherine Keener's character, who's the main romantic interest, she's sort of on this opposite track in terms of sexual awakening that the Carell character is, in the sense that she's looking maybe for the first time in her life to put real relationship before sex. So that's The 40-Year-Old Virgin, my number two pick.
I did consider it, Josh, but I think the reason I look past it, even though your explanation was great, is that the actual sexual awakening for the main character doesn't really come until the end of the film,
That great credit sequence. Yeah,
it really is good. So great film, though, a movie I do think is hilarious. My number two pick is a movie I think we can call Alfonso Cuarón's breakthrough film. He had made Great Expectations, but the movie where he became a name for me and a name a lot of cinephiles recognize was for Y Tu Mama Tambien from 2001. And, of course, we have recently discussed Gravity on the show, Josh, and we talked about the gender dynamics there. And it has struck me that you've got in Y Tu Mama Tambien, a film that obviously has Mama in the title and has a little bit of a maternal figure in this older woman. She's all of like 28 compared to the teen boys at the center. And then Children of Men is a film that is all centered around a pregnant woman's belly. And then, as I said, Gravity and all that talk about gender and Bullock's character and how important motherhood is. I think it's fodder probably for an essay by someone with a lot more time and insight than I have. But this is another coming of age story. You've got the two boys I mentioned going on a road trip with that slightly older woman played by Maribel Verdú. The stars, Diego Luna and Gael García Bernal, I think probably the first time I saw them on screen. Fantastic, fantastic actors, and have been so good in so many films after this. They are so good here. Another one, Josh, I badly need to revisit. I haven't seen it since 2001, and I didn't write about it then, but I do remember loving it. And of course, it is centered on these two young men who have already awakened to their sexuality. They've already engaged in sex. We see them at the beginning leaving their girlfriends and having one last fling, but they do come in the end to embrace a new side to their sexuality. And even though it's 12 years old, I'm not going to spoil it any further. I'll just say that, and everyone can enjoy watching the end of the movie. It's also, Josh, for me, one that stuck out in terms of this list because they're awakening to seeing the politics of sex and the ability to use sex as a weapon. There's a big sequence late in this film where we really see them all kind of trying to get back at each other or act out some kind of rage that they have really by engaging in different sexual activities. I think Cuarón's style does come through here. I remember that he's playing with conventional narrative techniques a little bit. You've also got a great friendship movie, a great road movie, and yes, a great coming of age movie. It just felt to me when I saw it then that it invigorated, it kind of breathed new life into some of those genres. So Y Tu Mama También is my number two.
Yeah, that's a really good pick. It was an honorable mention for me. My number one, however, is Splendor in the Grass from 1961. This is from Elia Kazan, and it's one of the swooniest teen melodramas you're probably ever going to see, at least one that doesn't star James Dean. I mean, it sways from these dreamy highs to tragic lows. It's kind of like spending a weekend with a lovesick teenager watching this picture. It's set in the late 1920s, and Natalie Wood stars as Deanie Loomis, a teen girl who's trying to resist sex with her boyfriend, Bud, and this is made harder because he's played by Warren Beatty, of course.
Deanie, I was just kidding. Look, I'm the one. I should go down on my knees to you, Deanie. I was just kidding. I thought you knew that.
I can't kid about these things. Because I am nuts about you. And I would go down on my knees to worship you if you really wanted me to. But I can't get along without you. And I would do anything you'd ask me to. I would. I would. Anything.
These two have all sorts of sexual influences bearing down upon them and swirling about them in this film. There's Deanie's puritanical mother. There's Bud's chauvinistic father. Bud also has this hard-partying older sister who has an unplanned pregnancy in the film. So these and other things are bearing down, especially on Deanie so much that she eventually has this breakdown and her parents wind up institutionalizing her. I think that movies often treat sexual awakening in particular as tied to a specific experience, if not a specific act. But Splendor in the Grass is interesting because it also captures the cultural and the societal influences that are also going on, especially, you know, before the sexual revolution of the late 1960s have even come into play. Mm-hmm. So Splendor in the Grass is my number one.
Yeah, it's probably my number six. It's one I really strongly consider for this list, mainly because I swear, if I'm remembering it correctly, there's a scene where Natalie Wood is so tormented by her sexual repression that she's like writhing on the floor of her kitchen or something.
Yep.
I mean, that's
how they play it.
Yeah, it's truly, she's so tortured by her lust for Warren Beatty that she goes crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
that's
so
essentially the plot.
That is a sexual awakening, and it's a great pick as your number one. I'm going to go back to the past in another movie that is set in a previous generation for my number one. It is The Last Picture Show, a movie from director Peter Bogdanovich. It was made in 1971, but it's set in the 50s, and it really probably should have been lower on my list because it's the one that most conspicuously lacks that Pleasantville bathtub moment. I'm not sure anybody in this movie ever actually enjoys sex, and it's another one I haven't seen in a long time. I remember reading the book, too, and loving it, but I don't think anyone, as I recall it, really ever enjoys sex for the pure pleasure of it. It's all about how it fills some emotional deficiency or advances some little agenda they have. There's certainly plenty of sex being wielded as a weapon, like in Y Tu Mama También. And in some cases, Josh, it's just a way to pass the time in this sleepy, sleepy, small Texas town. finally a way to be connected to someone, to something. And I think the two most memorable scenes in the movie by far, you mentioned Last Picture Show. I think a lot of people, a lot of fans of it, are going to mention one of these two scenes because they lay the groundwork for everything. They both involve characters being awakened to their sexuality in a way they aren't prepared for. The big one is the Sam Bottoms character, Billy, who has some mental challenges. He's with Dwayne and Sonny, played by Timothy Bottoms and Jeff Bridges, and this crew takes him out to help him lose his virginity finally. They take him out to this prostitute in the area to help him finally lose his virginity, and they end up shaming him. They end up embarrassing him and embarrassing themselves.
Which one of you bled his nose? I've told you all not to fight with Billy because he don't understand about fighting. What happened, Sonny?
They weren't none of us, Sam.
No, it was Jimmy Sue.
Jimmy Sue? How'd he get messed up with her?
We all chipped in and bought him a piece of ass. Thought he was getting tired of being a virgin. She got mad about something and blooded his nose.
Now you boys can get on out of here. I don't want to have no more to do with you. Scaring a poor, unfortunate creature like Billy just so as you could have a few laughs. I've been around that trashy behavior all my life. I'm getting tired of putting up with it.
Ben Johnson there as Sam the Lion. So good. He did win an Oscar for his performance. Cloris Leachman also won for Best Supporting Actress. And Josh, I haven't even mentioned her. That's really kind of the key sexual relationship in this movie, is the older housewife, the wife of the coach in town, developing that relationship with the Sonny character and them being able to advance their physical connection into something a little more intimate. I mentioned embarrassment. That other big scene that's so memorable, of course, is Cybill Shepherd going to the party, the college boys. She's the virgin. She's trying to impress them, and they make her get in the water where they're all swimming naked. She has to get on the diving board and strip in front of them. So shame really a part of sex here in The Last Picture Show. Just reading plot descriptions of the movie today made me realize how good the movie is. Like, I was reading some stuff on it to freshen up my memory, and I was just like, I need to go watch The Last Picture Show right now. It was a Best Picture nominee that year, up against A Clockwork Orange and The French Connection. And I think that would be a good film spotting deathmatch poll question. I know maybe you're not as big a fan of A Clockwork Orange, but
I really need to revisit it.
Yeah, you put those three together and pick the best one, see which one comes outstanding. That's a really, really hard choice. So my number one, the ultimate American movie about the loss of innocence, I think you could argue, The Last Picture Show. Those are our top five sexual awakening movies. Josh, we've heard a few of our honorable mentions. What are a few more of yours?
Another filmmaker that came to mind right away for me was Pedro Almodovar. And probably other listeners may have other films they'd put on this list. But this year's from his I'm So Excited, actually.
Which I still count. Need to see.
Swimming Pool from Francois Ozon with Charlotte Rampling. That was one that was probably number 7 or 8 for me. Unfaithful is an underrated Adrian Lyne film that has this great performance from Diane Lane.
She's great.
That could probably count for this list. All the Real Girls, second show in a row. That's an honorable mention for me. And then one more here, Hitchcock's Shadow of a Doubt, the sexual undercurrent going on there.
Yeah.
That was played up a little bit in Park Chan-wook's unofficial remake Stoker that we reviewed earlier this year.
Well, just to try and stave off some of the emails, two regrets, movies I really badly wanted to get to before forming my list but couldn't. My Summer of Love and the Bergman film Summer with Monica. A few more honorable mentions, the ones we've already heard, Splendor in the Grass, Brokeback Mountain. I also had All the Real Girls from David Gordon Green, but you could also go Bertolucci in The Dreamers, Hanukkah, your favorite director, Josh, and The Piano Teacher.
He's occasionally my favorite director.
Yes, occasionally. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, a movie I think I enjoy maybe a little bit more than you, and Heavenly Creatures, a film from Peter Jackson, I think could be in the mix as well. There are many, many other good films that I'm sure we left off, and we look forward to your emails. You can send your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter @FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, Thor, The Dark World, the sequel to Thor. What was the
Thor
title
was really
of that
good.
One?
What? I think it wasn't it just Thor?
It might have been just Thor. It was not very good, though.
It was one of those.
It was adequate.
It was one of those Marvel movies like Iron Man where a character that has always struck me as absolutely ridiculous made me really interested.
Okay. Well, I did not have that experience with Thor, so I'm unfortunately not really anticipating Thor: The Dark World. Some movies that I'm anticipating a little bit more, they're opening in limited release here in Chicago this weekend. Great Expectations. Yes, another adaptation. Helena Bonham Carter stars as Miss Havisham. Ralph Fiennes. Yes, indeed. And Sally Hawkins. It's directed by Mike Newell. How I Live Now, film that's come up a few times here on the show, directed by Kevin MacDonald with Saoirse Ronan. And The Trials of Muhammad Ali. This is from Chicago's very own Kartemquin Films. It's a documentary about Ali's battle to overturn his 5-year prison sentence for refusing to serve in Vietnam and really about the fallout of that. I have seen The Trials of Muhammad Ali, Josh, and can recommend it. Again, that opens this weekend, along with The Dallas Buyers Club, the new movie starring Matthew McConaughey and Jennifer Garner, along with Jared Leto. It's a movie set in the early to mid-80s there during the AIDS crisis, and McConaughey plays an HIV-positive Texas man who fought the medical establishment for alternative treatments. We're going to review that movie next week on the show, as well as share our top 5 actor transformations. And what we're looking for here are more physical transformations, like McConaughey for this role lost, I don't know how many pounds.
The weight loss, the weight gain.
The weight loss,
the
weight gain.
We'll find some other permutations of that, too, to include.
I'm sure we'll come up with a few. So that's next week's top 5. If you've got a really good pick you don't want us to ignore, email us feedback@filmspotting.net, or even better, leave us a voicemail explaining why you love that pick so much. 312-264-0744.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. The featured music this week comes from Indianapolis-based Lily and Madeline. It's from their self-titled debut album. More information is at lilyandmad.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.